You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. For more information, visit studylegalenglish.com. Hello and welcome to the Study Legal English podcast. I'm your host Louise and today I've got John Terry Dundon on the show. John is a professor of contract drafting, legal writing and constitutional law at Georgetown Law, where he draws on his experience as an attorney to make his teaching practical and realistic. I was introduced to John by Stephen Horowitz. Many of you listeners know Stephen. He's been on the show before and I very often mention him because he has introduced me to quite a few of my podcast guests. Anyway, last year I was in a call about contract drafting and I met John and I thought, he sounds like an interesting person to interview. And well, here we are today. So in this interview, we focus on his contract drafting teaching and we also talk about John's background as a private equity lawyer. So listeners, you are going to be hearing a lot of vocabulary related to contracts and also private equity. So things like PSA, recitals, indemnification, representations and warranties, covenants and IPO, private debt, bonds. Yes, many words there. Maybe you're familiar with them, maybe not. Well, we're going to be talking about all of those things today. Before we get started, I want to remind you that if you're a member, you can access your benefits over at studylegalenglish.com. If you're not a member, go to studylegalenglish.com/pricing to check out the member options. And final thing before we get started, I've got a question for you. In this interview with John, we talk about what his priorities are in teaching contracts. Now, I want to ask you, what is the most important thing you would like to learn about contracts? Let me know. Send me an email to louise@studylegalenglish.com or message me on social media. Just search for the Study Legal English group on Facebook or at Legal Englisher on or at Legal Englisher on Instagram. So let's get started. So John, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be here.
I'm super interested in learning about you, about your work, and I'm sure the listeners are too. How did you get to your position at Georgetown? What's your background?
Sure, yeah. I sort of think of my career as a bunch of things that happened to me rather than something that I planned out. In the United States, as you may know, a law degree is something you do after your four-year university degree. And it's also something that people often do as a default, when they're not really sure what they want to do with their life. It's sort of perceived as being a good option for people who think of themselves as being smart but don't really like math. So I was one of those people. I had two useless humanities majors as an undergraduate, went to law school, was kind of hoping to do anything other than be a lawyer. But I learned through my program that those kind of sexy jobs that have a neat job description but don't involve actually representing everyday clients, those are very hard to come by. So I ended up serendipitously at a large law firm doing something I knew nothing about when I was in law school, private equity fund formation, which is something I could tell you as much or as little as you'd ever want to know about. Did that, ended up moving up to New York City and did a similar practice area at two other firms. There were elements of it that I certainly enjoyed, but at no point did I ever think it was what I wanted to do with my life permanently. So the time came, as it often does, when a person has to leave the law. And there was a program at Columbia, not far from where I was living at the time. It was a part-time program offering a certificate in teaching English to speakers of other languages. In the U.S., we call it a TESOL certificate. So I did that part-time and worked for a friend of mine who I had worked with at two of my former firms. She had a travel company. I worked as sort of her COO. And after a nine-month program, launched a teaching career. So your first job at anything is often very hard to come by. So the advice I kept getting was volunteer for a while and then you'll be an attractive candidate. So I decided to get the best of both worlds and get a trip out of it too. So I volunteered in South Asia for 4 months when I returned to New York, I had no problem getting a bunch of different teaching jobs, primarily to immigrant communities in the New York area, community colleges, students who were citizens but had moved to the U.S. as children and didn't have a good handle on academic language yet. And as I started doing that, I found my way into Fordham Law School, which was also nearby. The dean of the international program there had been looking for someone like me for quite some time, someone with a legal background who was also a language teacher. There are certainly many, many students in the U.S. who would like to study law, but don't have the requisite level of English proficiency. So we started a program there. And while I did that, I went back to Columbia and completed a master's degree. The credits I had earned in my TESOL certificate counted towards my MA, so it made a lot of sense at the time. So I was a part-time student and working several jobs at once. And shortly after I graduated, got a call out of the blue to come join the program at Georgetown Law, which was a program I certainly had known a lot about. And I was very eager and excited to accept, and sort of here I am.
Okay, good. So you mentioned a couple of words there. First of all, you mentioned COO.
Chief Operating Officer.
Chief Operating Officer. And you mentioned also that you were dealing in private equity funds. Are you able to explain what that is in like a couple of sentences?
Sure. There are two ways to think about private equity. It's a way to get money. There are giant oceans of money out there that a lot of people aren't aware of. And these oceans of money are allocated as investments to a bunch of different things. And private equity is one way to get that money down to private companies that need funds to grow their business. Something I wasn't really cognizant of before I became a private equity lawyer is, you know, every university endowment or insurance company or sovereign wealth fund or bank just has billions, sometimes even trillions of dollars that it holds. And that money doesn't just sit there. If it sits there, it immediately starts to lose value to inflation. So it has to be deployed. And so a really big, you know, like in the United States, a giant pension fund from a company or a state government or something will allocate, you know, 40% to stocks, 40% to bonds, and 10% to real estate. And it'll have a 10% slice to something called alternative investments. And private equity is one of those alternative investments. So it is an investment class for big institutional investors. That's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is if you are sort of a medium-sized company and you need money to grow, there are really two sources. You can sell equity or you can get a loan. And so if you're going to get a loan, you could get a big credit facility from a bank. That would be private debt. You could issue bonds to the public. That would be public debt. On the equity side, you could issue equity to the public. That would be an IPO, which is difficult and expensive. Or you could sell shares in your company privately. And so private equity funds are sitting out there and they have great networks for finding companies that need money. And they tend to be in the right place at the right time and will typically buy a very large stake or even a controlling stake in companies and help them reorganize and professionalize their management and grow. And then they will sell them off 5 to 10 years later at a big profit. So what I was doing was I was sort of in the middle in between these investors at the top and the private equity funds. And I would help the private equity funds negotiate the terms of the investment by these institutional investors, you know, $100 million at a time, $2 billion at a time. And then once we sort of formed the fund, we'd pass it off to the mergers and acquisitions group, which would then have ideally that fund as a client for the next 5 to 10 years and help them buy and sell companies and recapitalize them. So there are a lot of lawyers out there who would describe themselves as private equity, but most of those are what I would consider to be an M&A attorney, whereas I was what we called ourselves would be a fund formation attorney. There are far fewer of us out there because it's only needed once in the life of a fund.
So quite a niche, perhaps, a niche
definitely.
Area.
Yeah. Definitely.
So John, you mentioned an IPO. What exactly is that?
An IPO is an acronym for initial public offering and might be something some of your listeners will have seen in the news. If there's a company that needs to sell equity to the public, the very first time they do so, it's called an initial public offering. After an IPO, of course, a company can have many, many other subsequent public offerings. They go by different names.
Thank you. Okay. And you mentioned that you were doing some teaching in South Asia.
Correct. I connected with, it was actually a charity based in the UK. It's a couple with family connections to South Asia. And they set me up with two volunteer opportunities. One was at a nursing college in Tamil Nadu in South India. One thing that's interesting about India from a linguistic perspective is their entire medical education system is conducted exclusively in English. So the students I taught had studied English as a second language for their primary and secondary education, but were going to be beginning an English medium program for the first time in their life. So I had them for about 2 months over the summer before their program began, where we just really just did English conversation all day. And then after that, I went to Sri Lanka. There is a sort of constellation of universities and centers of Buddhist studies all over Sri Lanka, but I was based in Kandy in the center. There was several centers with monks from all over the world, primarily from Southeast Asia. And they, interestingly, all wanted to learn English because it was the only way they could really communicate with monks from other Buddhist traditions. So that's why they were interested in learning English. Many of them were there for actually an academic program. Some of them were getting a PhD in Buddhism, interestingly, at the university there. So I taught there for a couple months as well. Very fun.
Did you become a Buddhist?
No, in many ways, I've considered myself to be a Buddhist philosophically, although interestingly, the way Buddhism was practiced, at least in the environment that I saw there, is very different from the way, you know, we conceive of Buddhism here in the West. There are elements there to the practice that we certainly don't see here, you know, worshiping minor deities and various social taboos that we certainly don't have. But, you know, I did learn a lot, and I would often use questions about Buddhist philosophy as our subject matter for conversation. And, you know, I would be writing down everyone's answers as quickly as I could because I thought it was so interesting to get these. All of my students were monks. I did have a few nuns as well, but primarily I taught monks. They were all members of the clergy and took their faith very seriously. It was very interesting to hear what they had to say.
Wow, what an experience.
Yeah. And
yeah, I imagine quite a deep experience, perhaps. So moving from your language teaching in general to your legal English teaching, can you explain a little bit about how you actually teach contract drafting?
Sure. So one thing I'll say before I begin a description of the class itself, our philosophy in our program at Georgetown Law is we do have some classes that are explicitly language focused, but most of the curriculum, we're sort of trying to hide the language. We are studying substantive topics and practicing language as we do. So I guess that's the first thing I'll say. And so it's very much a class about contract drafting, and ideally we'll pick up some language on the side. The other thing I'll say is our students all come for different reasons and have different career trajectories. Many of them will go back home and practice at a local law firm, practicing local law, but they won't necessarily ever use English. Some of them will continue to get something that's called an SJD, which is like a doctorate in law. You would rarely meet an American who gets that. It's primarily foreign students who want to teach back home. Many of our students will do that. A handful of them will do what I think would be the biggest reach, particularly for a lawyer who is primarily been educated in a different jurisdiction, which would be to try and practice law in the United States at a U.S. law firm or at a firm in their home country that nevertheless services U.S. clients. That's a very difficult thing to do in a language that is not your own. Most students who do that will find themselves doing transactional law rather than litigation. I think there are far more commonalities to transactions around the world than there are for, you know, litigation strategies, for example. So, you know, drafting a contract in New York is not really any different than drafting a contract in Hong Kong. So the class has been designed for those students who would like to try and do sort of the most difficult thing that they might do, which is to go, you know, do contract drafting at a U.S. firm. The class is really designed to teach them the things I wish someone had taught me before I began. So it's very much law firm focused, you know, real client focused. So what we do in that class is, you know, my practice area was private equity fund formation. That's what I know. So we use a contract from that area of law because, you know, I can answer pretty much any question I might get about it. So we begin the semester and very few students know anything about finance or private equity. So I give a brief sort of introduction to that and I frame it as we're going to have a client. And when you have a client, you need to learn everything you can about their line of business. So let me teach you a little bit about our client's line of business. And then we take a very simple, sort of the most simple contract that I ever dealt with as an attorney is there's a transaction when private equity fund is a limited partnership and each investor owns an interest in it. And sometimes they will transfer their interest to someone else. They'll leave the fund and someone else will come in. So we have a very simple purchase and sale agreement for that. The reason I like this kind of agreement is it's got sort of all the important elements that many, many much bigger contracts might have, but it has them in shortened form. And the thing that's being sold is this little abstract asset. So we don't have to add a bunch of stuff into the contract about the asset itself. Just to give you sort of a counterexample, if you were to do an agreement where you were buying and selling, I don't know, a factory, you'd have to learn so much about factories and their physical space and the environmental laws and the intellectual property laws. And we'd spend the whole semester putting all that sort of junk into the contract. With this clean, discrete asset, I can focus on really the elements of the contract that are always there. You know, the preamble and recitals up at the top, how to define terms work, very simple set of reps and warranties. We start the semester with a contract that signs and closes on the same day. And we break that out into having a signing on one day and a delayed closing later on. The contract we start with is only 7 or 8 pages long. And over the course of the semester, we build it out. So we go section by section. We learn about it. I'll give sort of a brief lecture about each section and what it does, or each article and what it does. We'll look at a few other examples. So I sort of give my students a bank of contracts. Some are much, much longer than the ones we're looking at, just so they can compare and contrast and see the different ways these things can look. And then I do them every 2 weeks. I will give them an assignment where I say, okay, I've taught you about indemnification provisions. Here are some elements of an indemnification provision that I would like you to add. And they'll do these in groups, and I have them pretend that they are a group of associates and they've been on a call with a client, and the client has said, this is what I want. And then they send me a new draft of the contract. Something I never really knew about before I started working at a firm is you never just send someone a sheet of paper and say, read it. You send them a comparison against the prior version. At a US firm, at least, we would call that a red line. There's a way you can run a red line on Microsoft Word. So they send me the new draft of the contract with a red line that shows their changes. And then very importantly, they email it to me. And in the email, they must simulate sort of a law firm cover email. This is what I'm sending you. And these are the changes that you will see when you open the document. So there are really two halves to the course. One is, how do we tinker with contractual language and what is the process for doing that? And then arguably more importantly, how do we describe these different contractual elements and sort of what they're doing using everyday language? And we go through the whole semester doing that. And then the final exam is something they do at home on their own computer, but it's timed and it's just another contract drafting exercise like we've been doing all semester.
So it's very practical and drawing on your own experience working as an attorney and really preparing the students for if they then go and draft contracts in English in a law firm. Okay, so John, you mentioned a few words related to contracts there. You mentioned the preamble, the recitals, the definitions. You mentioned indemnification clause. Can you just explain a little bit about what those are?
Sure. Very briefly, the preamble and recitals are the part at the very beginning of the contract that says, you know, this contract is between party A and party B on this particular date. And the recitals, they can be long or short, and they just sort of explain what's going on. So a very simple purchase agreement, they'll just say party A wants to sell, party B wants to buy. If it's an agreement in like a big complex transaction, they'll often be a much longer set of recitals sort of saying this agreement relates to this one and that one. And they can be helpful 10 years later if you're dusting off the document and trying to figure out, you know, what was going on in this deal. And indemnification is a little bit more esoteric. It is a framework that you would put in the agreement to try and keep out of court if someone breaches. So rather than if I breach the contract, your only remedy is to sue me, we can add a bunch of detail in the contract that says, if I breach, this is what will happen. This is the maximum amount I can pay you. This is how you can get your money from me. And what parties like about the indemnification is it sort of allows us to limit how bad things can get. We say, look, we're going to make it easier for you to get me and me to get you, but we'll have a total cap on damages. So you can't sue me for like $10 billion like you would be able to do in court. And we can also put like a lower limit on things and say, don't come after me unless your damages are more than $1 million. You know, this is a $100 million transaction. Don't waste my time. We'll both run up a bunch of legal fees. We can also do things like cut off the amount of time we could have to sue each other. So whereas in the real world, if for breach of contract, maybe you have 5 years to sue me, we can just say, look, if nothing's come up within a year of the closing, we both just walk away. We're done here. So parties like that a lot.
So John, can you tell me some of the typical clauses that you use inside the contract that you use when you're teaching contract drafting?
Sure. One of the big ones is when two parties are getting ready to, you know, one's going to buy something and one is going to sell something, what they like to do is take what's sort of like a snapshot of the way things are now. And these are the facts that our willingness to enter into the transaction is predicated on. So some will relate to the asset, and these are primarily going to be things the seller says, you know, I actually own it. It doesn't have any debt I didn't tell you about. There's nothing wrong with it. Each party will make certain representations about itself. I am who I say I am. I'm allowed to enter into this transaction. I haven't been sued for any felonies. I'm not a terrorist. And then we'll also make representations about the contract itself. You know, I don't need anybody's permission to sign this. There's no law out there that would prevent me from entering into this. This agreement, to the best of my knowledge, is enforceable in the jurisdiction where I am. So these can be longer or shorter. As I mentioned before, one thing I like about my contract that I use is the asset itself is fairly discreet and simple. When the asset gets more complicated, whether it's a factory or a whole company or, God forbid, like a conglomerate of companies with IP and stuff out there, intellectual property, the reps and warranties can be dozens and dozens of pages and will often be the primary focus of the negotiations. The other big one I haven't mentioned is the contract that I have my class begin with is quite simple. It's what in U.S. legal English we call a sign-and-close. We're signing it and we consummate the sale on the same day. More commonly, for a variety of reasons, we'll come to a business agreement. The parties will come to a business agreement and we won't actually be able to sell the thing until later on because we're waiting on someone else's permission. Either a third party has a contractual right or we need some sort of regulatory approval. So we sign on one day and we have a closing later on. It's called a delayed closing transaction. And this causes a problem because we're on the hook and the seller's got to send the thing and the buyer's got to send the money, but we're waiting and we really don't want anything to sort of be messed up in the meantime. So we add a new article to the agreement called covenants, where we both make promises about our conduct. Things we promise to do, and really more importantly, things we promise not to do. And then when we reach the closing date, we have to send each other a sheet of paper that says, I've done all the things I said I was going to do, and I haven't done any of the things I said I wasn't going to do. And the other party sends one the other direction, and only then do we do the closing.
And is the heading in the contract actually covenants, or do you call it something else?
Yeah, so there'll be like Article 1 will be definitions. Article 2 will just be something short about the closing. These numbers really are quite consistent among contracts of all sizes. Article 3 will be representations of the seller. Article 4 of the buyer. Article 5 will be the covenants. Article 6 and 7 will be the closing conditions for each side. Next comes the indemnification provision, if there is one. There'll be some tax provisions in there that I've pulled out of my contract. And then the very last will be this long article called miscellaneous that actually has a lot of really important stuff about how we handle dispute resolution and certain rules for interpretation of the contract in the event of a dispute.
Do you have like a termination clause in there as well or not?
It depends. So with termination, if there is an article with closing conditions, there is an implicit right of termination there. If you don't do your closing conditions, I don't have to close. In other words, I get to terminate. I have that right, whether or not we say that explicitly. In addition, we've signed a piece of paper that says we're going to close a sale. We can always sign a new sheet of paper that says, hey, remember that old sheet of paper? Well, it's canceled. So we can always terminate by mutual consent, whether the agreement explicitly says that. The time where adding termination becomes useful is if you want to have penalties for certain kinds of termination occurring. This is really big in the M&A world. The seller is the one who's most likely to screw something up with the asset that's being sold in between signing and closing. So many agreements have what's called a termination fee, which is if we don't close because the seller breached one of its covenants, then in addition to the buyer getting to walk away, the seller has to pay, I don't know, $70 million or something like that. What I tell my students is that unless we're going to add something like that, we don't really need a termination provision.
Yeah. And the covenants section, have you ever seen it called anything else? Is sometimes it just called obligations?
So the time you'll see the word obligations is in these closing conditions. Sometimes they're called obligations prior to closing. Sometimes they're called conditions precedent to closing. At least in a U.S. contract, typically covenants are just called covenants. It's a bit of a term of art. There's no reason why you couldn't call them obligations. I just think the word covenant specifically refers to things the parties have to do or not do in between signing and closing. That's what that word means in our legal system. So that's the word everyone uses.
Okay. And you mentioned about, you know, you sometimes put in about the dispute resolution. Is it more common to have arbitration rather than litigation to resolve the disputes in the kind of contracts you're dealing with?
Interestingly, in the private equity world, effectively every single actor has an office in New York or has a lawyer with an office in New York. And for better or for worse, the courts, particularly the federal court in New York City, is trusted as a fair arbiter of disputes and works pretty well. So most contracts that I deal with have a New York choice of law clause and dispute resolution taking place in New York. That having been said, the contracts also always include a provision that require each party to waive its right to trial by jury. So though we are in a court, we have a bench trial, which keeps things much quicker and much more simple. I tend to see arbitration more commonly in sales of goods, whereas the contracts that I'm working on are sales of an intangible partnership asset. So almost never in my career did I work on a contract with arbitration. That having been said, arbitration is a subject matter that is of high interest to many, if not most, of my students. So I do include in a few of our agreements that we look at some arbitration provisions. And in many years, I have students strip out the New York court stuff and substitute in arbitration provisions as one of my assignments or on the exam sometimes.
It's probably quite a helpful one to include. It can get quite complicated between the seat and then the governing law of the contract and the governing law of arbitration and the venue and all of that. So sounds like a good idea. Very nice. So John, you mentioned in the call when I first met you that you don't necessarily focus on plain English. What's your approach with plain English when you're teaching contract drafting?
Sure. I mean, the first thing I'll say sort of philosophically about plain English is it's always been very hard for me to disentangle a contract that's not written in plain English from a contract that is just poorly drafted. I learned a lot about plain English as a law student in connection with legal research and memo writing. I'm less familiar with what a plain English teacher would say about contract drafting. My guess is that it would be avoid words like hereinafter and things like that, which is something I would tell my students to do anyway. The main reason I don't focus too much on stylistic considerations is I guess where I would mentally file plain English, is when you're a junior attorney, there are other things that are frankly more important for you to know and that you're more likely to need to use than changing the style of the contract to make it a little bit easier to read. At all three firms where I worked and all of the different firms that I worked with sort of across the table, you know, the way contracts are drafted, it's very rare that anyone, particularly an associate, just opens a Word document and drafts a provision de novo. What we always do, and this is what I teach my students, is we figure out what we need substantively. We think of the closest example we have in another contract we've worked on previously that does something similar, closer the better. We bring that language over into our contract, and then we massage it. We change the defined terms. We make sure it doesn't overlap with anything we already have. Sometimes we break it apart and put some of it here and some of it there. You know, while you're doing that, as you're massaging the language, if you can make it a little more clear, that's great. But the partner in the real world is going to say, where did you get this? And can I see where you got it from? And how different is it? The partner is always going to say, or the client's going to say, this provision from this older contract was used before, it worked before, you know, maybe it's been pressure tested in litigation, we know it works. So, you know, why risk anything by changing the language? Let's just use what we have. I don't want to be the one who tries to get fancy and make it a little cleaner, and then, you know, the whole thing blows up because it's not interpreted the way we wanted it to be interpreted. I mean, to be clear, pun intended, there are definitely better and worse ways to write a contract. And I have definitely noticed over the years at the various firms I've worked, some firms have precedent that I think is much easier to work with than others. That's often a function of someone taking the time as these documents accrete over the years of just combing through it a bit and cleaning it up and, you know, getting rid of things that don't need to be there anymore. That's not going to be the kind of thing that most of my students will encounter professionally, at least not for many years. So it's just, there are other more pressing matters that I focus on.
Good. So as you mentioned, it's difficult to distinguish between a contract that's not written in plain English and a contract that's just badly drafted. You mentioned that plain English, it's not really a priority. So what is the priority?
I think the biggest problem that I had when I was a law student, which is a problem shared by many of my students, is that we all know what it's like to go to court, and we've seen it on TV. Very few people have any idea of what really the day-to-day work of a transactional lawyer is. I write contracts. What does that even mean? I try to help students understand that there's sort of a process. We'll always have something around that we're starting with, and it will be pretty close to what we need, or it will be quite different. The client will give us instructions about things that they have agreed to with the other side. And then we don't just open a Word document and start typing. We go look for precedent and we bring the precedent in. And then there are certain pitfalls that all of my students trip over on in the beginning of the semester. And I make them aware of those. You know, this agreement that we're borrowing from uses purchaser, but ours uses buyer. This one had multiple sellers. Ours just has one. I mean, that's the easy stuff, but you can't ever forget it. Basic things. A lot of my students have no idea sort of how to format a document. A lot of my students might read a provision with representations and warranties, but if asked to describe it in an email, the only thing they really know how to do would be to paste the provision into the email and just say, here you go. They don't know how to say things in a shorter way. So it's really those sort of basic skills that would be helpful to have when you walk in the door to a law firm that ordinarily would take you 6 to 9 months to learn. And at the same time, I try to make students aware that the same skills we're working on here will be useful for doing other things too. Writing a professional email in a simulated law firm setting is good practice for emailing your professors in other classes and asking for references one day and drafting a cover letter for an internship application that has your resume. And the same principles of contract drafting we do in a PSA would be helpful, you know, if you go work for the World Bank or something and you're working on a memorandum of understanding. These are broad-based skills that are going to be useful anywhere, and in particular, if you do some kind of transactional law at a major law firm.
Okay, so you prioritize what the students really need to do in reality, which is they're going to be working on contracts potentially. And when they do that, they're not just going to write a contract from scratch. They're going to get a contract from somewhere. But you're looking at avoiding the pitfalls, the copy and paste pitfalls, making sure that everything is actually consistent in the contract. They're not using buyer instead of purchaser if somewhere else in the contract it says one of those, not the other. And then also focusing on making sure that they can explain these contract clauses in an email. Those skills are transferable. They can use them when they're applying for jobs or internships, emailing their professors, as you mentioned. Now, it sounds like you draw a lot from your experience, but do you have any kind of top resources that you do recommend for contract drafting?
No. And what I tell my students is there are some subjects that are a what, and there are other subjects that are a how. So things that are a how would be speaking a language or riding a bike or playing a violin or drafting contracts. You can't pick up a book and read about how to balance on a bike. You've got to get up there. You've got to fall down. You've got to have someone help you out. In my view, contract drafting is the same way. I did not have a class on contract drafting that I was able to take as a law student. And if I had had one, I would have wanted it designed fairly similar to the one that I'm doing now. I do have one book, actually I have it in my bookshelf right here, called Working with Contracts by someone named Charles Fox. He's a former corporate partner at Skadden, very much knows what he's talking about. This is the only book that I have on my syllabus. It's not required. It's just recommended for those who might like something as a reference. What I tell my students is that the most valuable reference for their future career will be the contract that we worked on in class, because that's how attorneys learn. All of the precedent that you have personally worked on, you add to your own sort of bank. And those are the things you know and understand that you can then use later on in other contracts. I wish there were a book I could tell students, you know, read this and you'll learn everything that I didn't tell you that we didn't have time for. But in my view, that book doesn't exist.
Okay. You also teach, or you have previously taught legal English. Was your approach different for legal English? Did you have resources that you recommended for learning legal English?
Well, you know, legal English is a little bit of a how as well, in that I can give you a list of terms of art in American legal English and you can study them, but you're not really going to learn unless you are given an essay assignment and make mistakes and have a professor, you know, help you think about what you did wrong and how you can use them differently. We have a textbook that we use. One of our former faculty members drafted it. It's called Academic Legal Discourse and Analysis by Baffi and Schatzel. This is a great book, but again, it's designed to be used as a textbook for a course. It would take quite an ambitious student to be able to use this on his or her own, you know, give yourself essay assignments and try and grade them yourself. You know, that's what's frustrating about learning a language or really learning a skill is it needs to be learned through experience.
I do understand what you mean, because, you know, as a language learner myself, I understand that, as you say, you can't just like read a grammar book and you're going to know the language. You have to practice it. You have to make mistakes. You've got to speak in the real world and write in the real world. And that's kind of how you learn a language. But I know that you learn languages too, or you certainly speak quite a few languages. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say that I speak them. These are languages that I dabble in. That would be a better way of saying it.
Okay, you dabble in the languages. When you learn languages, I mean, surely, do you use dictionaries? Do you use like websites?
Of course. I mean, there are dictionaries. You know, the analogy for learning legal English would be get yourself a giant Black's Law dictionary. I've got one here. It's about 3,000 pages long. This is very difficult to use, though, as a study tool. You know, I'm learning Hungarian right now. I have a Hungarian dictionary, but it's not often that I consult my Hungarian dictionary. What I find most helpful is having one-on-one conversations with my teacher and making a ton of errors.
Yeah.
Hungarian is very hard.
Wow. So clearly you're someone who likes a challenge because you're learning Hungarian. And also, I understand what you mean. Like, yeah, you can pick up a Black's dictionary or a dictionary, but legal English in particular, you certainly can't understand it just from reading a dictionary, especially because the concepts are kind of attached to the law and you really need to learn it with a teacher. It's quite difficult to study on your own, I guess. So my next question is, what's your biggest achievement? I've put related to the legal field, but You can surprise me.
You know, so right now I am a full-time faculty member and I'm a father to a small child and I'm getting a PhD in linguistics. And people sometimes say, wow, that must be really stressful. And what I tell them is, actually, it is orders of magnitude less stressful than just a regular day at the office as a senior associate at a major firm. What I consider my biggest achievement is something that hundreds, if not thousands, of people are doing right now as we speak, which is surviving and doing a good job at that, what I consider to be sort of the most difficult level of legal practice, is at least at a US firm, would be sort of a senior associate or junior service partner, where you're the one actually doing the work and you're the one, you know, the buck stops with you. When you're a junior associate, the hours are terrible and it's stressful and you don't know what's going on. But, you know, when you make mistakes, someone higher up will catch them for you, usually. When you're a very senior partner, yes, you've got all these clients and you've got to keep them happy, but you're delegating down to very capable people whom you trust deeply. When you're at that level, you know, it's the senior associate or the junior partner who's up at 4 a.m. every single night going through the closing checklist, checking every document, checking everyone else's stupid errors, you know, managing multiple transactions at the same time without having a nervous breakdown. I got up to that level and survived at it for a few years and then left to do other things. But that's the time in my life where I think I was really using all cylinders of the engine. And almost everything I've done after that has seemed much easier by comparison. And things that I had not been good at, such as keeping cool under pressure and not getting overwhelmed when you have a million things going on and having really good ways of making sure you never drop the ball, those are things I feel like I'm really good at now. And I owe it all to that traumatic period of my life when I was doing it at a firm. So, you know, that's really the part of my career that I'm most proud of. And sort of everything else I'm doing now is, you know, just as busy as I am, I feel like I'm just sort of playing around. You know, I take my job very, very seriously, but the level of job-related stress is just a shadow of what I used to have.
So now you've got a bit more work-life balance, it sounds, even though you're still doing a huge amount. You know, you're a full-time faculty member, you're doing a PhD as well, and you've got a family, which is, all of those things are, you know, huge things in themselves. But compared to when you were working as a senior associate, it's kind of like, I don't know, you've got more space to breathe. I think that's quite an important point that you make. When you really push yourself outside of your comfort zone, it's really difficult. It could be really, really hard at the time, but then that's always going to be a reference point to go back to later on in life. So you've had quite a varied career so far, and it still sounds like it continues to be varied. Is there something that you wish that you'd known when you first started, when you first went into the law, that you do know now, like kind of advice that you could have given yourself at the beginning?
If there's anything I think I could have told myself, it would have been, it was something of which I was vaguely aware at the time, but I realize now even more so, is the value of the relationships with the people you're working with. To this day, some of my best friends and closest former colleagues and best sort of networking connections as well are the people I worked with at my very first firm. Fortunately, I don't think I made too many people angry and didn't make too many horrible mistakes. I guess that there are people that I've lost touch with that I wish I had not lost touch with. So maybe I would tell myself, you know, really make an effort to try and even just make occasional light contact with the people that you know and see how they're doing and see if there's anything you can do for them, and your future will be better for it.
So contacts are very, very important for listeners. If you're kind of at the beginning of your career, make sure that you pay attention to the relationships that you build and keep in touch with people. So talking about kind of people in general, who are the three people, or do you have three or one person who has been the most influential for you?
That's a difficult question for me to answer. I suppose there are various areas of my life where one person has been influential or not. Since we've been talking about, you know, my professional career and the legal side of things, I would definitely say they were at my very first law firm. The way I got into private equity fund formation was I was sitting around minding my own business as a junior associate, did a little work here and there, hadn't really specialized, and got a call out of the blue. I was working in Washington at the time from our New York office, and there were two senior associates on the line. And at the time, I'd been working a lot for a partner in our DC office named Andy. And they said, "You don't know who we are, but Andy just sold you out. You're on our deal now." You know, I spent the next 9 months sort of doing nothing except living and breathing inside this particular transaction. These two senior associates were very kind, very patient, great at taking a little bit of extra time to bring me up to speed on what's going on. And, you know, without having had someone like that at that point in my career, I would have made it, you know, much less time than I did. I certainly wish for everyone that they have someone like that right at the beginning, particularly at a law firm where it's so easy to become overwhelmed. You know, much of what I teach my students, much of what I taught this past semester are lessons that I learned from them, either explicitly or from just watching them do their thing. There was a time, probably during the climax of the transaction, where every single day at 8 a.m., we'd have a conference call with our client and their investor who was in Europe. And we'd spend several hours going over the document. And then the call would end and the partner would spend about an hour giving us very specific instructions. And then we'd go get lunch and then spend the whole afternoon and evening fixing the contract and running red lines. And then we'd usually send it out internally to our partners in the late evening and sit around at the office and wait until 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. when we got everyone's comments back. And then we'd sit around a computer, the three of us, and we would draft this cover email that was going to like 160 people. You know, it was our clients, many, many people there, the partners in our practice area, the tax partners, the people on the other side and their lawyer. I mean, just so many people. So like any single mistake would have been disastrous. And we'd sit here in front of the Microsoft Outlook and we'd spend, you know, 90 minutes drafting an email and triple checking all the email addresses and making sure they were in an order that makes sense and triple checking our attachments to make sure they opened. You know, what I tell my students is, you certainly don't need to spend an hour writing an email to me, but an email is something that is composed, not something that is written like a text message, you know, and it's little things like that, sort of being able to ride along with them, ride shotgun, as we say in US English. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have learned from them. They made the next 8 years of my career so much easier.
Gosh, I can see why now you say your life is a little bit easier in comparison to when you were working as a senior associate, staying up basically or almost all night to work on transactions. So you're kind of highlighting the importance of trying to find someone who is there who can kind of act as almost like a bit like a mentor. And so to look out for those people, try to establish those, especially if you're going through kind of a difficult time in your work or something. And the point that you make about the email writing, I think it's quite easy to fall into the, I don't know, bad habit of just kind of writing an email as you would write a LinkedIn message. I'm sometimes guilty of that. Spending a bit of time just making sure that everything is correct is definitely good advice. So, you know, if listeners have got a question about anything from today, can they connect with you on LinkedIn?
Please do. Yeah, I would love that. I love getting questions that are interesting from people I've never met and sharing what I can and maybe learning a little bit from them as well.
Excellent. Good. Okay. So you can find John on LinkedIn. Just search for John Terry Dundon and you'll find it. I'll leave, of course, all the links in the show notes. So do get in touch with John if you've got any questions about kind of contract drafting, what we've talked about today, and he'll very kindly be happy to answer your questions. So John, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been super interesting. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been so fun. It's great to get to know you a little better as well and some of your listeners, hopefully. And again, if there's anyone out there listening, if there's any way I can help you with your legal English or with your contract drafting class, please don't hesitate to reach out. I'd love to hear from you.
Great. So that's the end of this episode. I hope you found it useful and learned something new. Remember my question. What is the most important thing you would like to learn about contracts? Send me an email to louise@studylegalenglish.com or find me on social media, the Study Legal English group, or at Legal Englisher on Instagram. Of course, if you're a member, head over to studylegalenglish.com for all your membership benefits. And if you're thinking of becoming a member, go to studylegalenglish.com/pricing. So thanks for listening and see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Study Legal English podcast. If you really want to get ahead, why not become a member and gain access to many learning resources? Visit studylegalenglish.com/pricing.